Good morning. So I wanted to, any questions about anything before I jump in? Okay, so I wanted to finish up chapter 17, just a few little loose ends, and then get on to chapter 18. So chapter 17 is mostly about expected value and standard error, which I mostly covered Friday. As I mentioned then, expected value is section 1 of the chapter, standard error is section 2. Section 3 talks a little bit about the normal curve, and I mentioned a couple things about it, but I'm mostly skipping over that until we get to chapter 18, which will be later this lecture. And then the last two sections are pretty quick. So section 4 and section 5 of chapter 17 just deal with, section 4 just deals with this one detail, and section 5 kind of gives an overview of the chapter. So I'll just label this, I guess, chapter 17, section 4. This chapter, I think, is more clearly organized than a lot of the chapters in the book that have sections that are sort of, short or not that important. I feel like this one chapter has, it's very, very organized. So this section is about this shortcut for calculating the standard deviation. It's unfortunately useful only in a fairly specific case. It's a specific case that comes up pretty often, but don't get too excited. It's a shortcut for calculating the standard deviation when the box contains only two different numbers, or only two different values. So unfortunately, it's not going to help you with really complicated boxes, but these boxes come up pretty often, boxes that contain only two different values. 0-1 boxes are a very common case of this box with just a 0 and a 1 in it, or maybe some number of zeros, some number of 1s. So the shortcut, SD shortcut, the formula is this. So there are only two different values. One of them is bigger than the other one. So take the big one, subtract the small one, and then multiply by the square root of the fraction big times the fraction small. So that can be done in either order, obviously, right? You could multiply fraction big times fraction small, or fraction small times fraction big. So the fraction of one of them times the fraction of the other one. Then you have this multiplier in front. So this is a little bit quicker than the usual SD formula. So I think it's worth using, but like I say, it's not that exciting. It's not going to help you deal with complicated boxes, right? So also notice I'm talking about this in the context of a box model, but you can use this to calculate the SD of any data set or any list of numbers that has only two different values. Okay, so let's do an example of that. Oops. So first, really quick example for coin tosses. I'm just talking about the SD of the box, so I don't really care how many draws I have or how many coin tosses I have. I'm just thinking about this kind of abstractly. The SD of this box by that shortcut is, so there are two different values there, right? So you take the big one, subtract the small one, big one being 1, small one being 0, and multiply by the square root of fraction big, fraction small. So 1 minus 0 out in front is just 1. And then square root of a half times a half is a half. Okay, so you might remember we did that on Friday to find the SD of a coin box for a coin toss, and it was a half. It's pretty quick to find the SD of that box anyway, just using the regular, either the RMS of deviations from average formula or using the summation formula. But I think, this gains you a little bit. So that's one. Let me give you one more example, which is the for roulette. Where is it? There we go. So let me first describe the game of roulette. So roulette is a game, you have a roulette wheel. So there are 38 slots on this wheel. I'm not going to try to make this exactly the right number. But anyway, a bunch of slots. And the way the game works is you spin the wheel around and then throw a ball in a little groove, and the ball spins around and the wheel spins around, and eventually the ball stops in one of the 38 slots. So the 38 slots, so they're each equally likely, and they're labeled 1 through 36, 0, and 00. And they also have colors. So of these 36, you know, numbered 1 through 36, there are 18 red, 18 black. Oops, black. And these two are green. So two green. So you can bet on pretty much anything you want. In any combination of results you want to bet. You can bet on a single number or a color. Those are the most common bets that people make. But you can bet on any kind of group of outcomes you want. And the casino has decided what they should pay you if that comes up, so that they make a small amount of money on average, right? So you'll see that this, in the language of statistics or probability, this has a negative expected value for the player, right? So that's how we sort of think about whether or not a game is for you or against you. Okay, so let's do one example of this. Let's say we bet on red 100 times. Bet $1 on red 100 times. And I want to find the expected value in the standard error. So remember, the intuition behind the expected value standard error is expected value tells you about what you expect to happen, right? So if for example, if everyone in the class made these 100 bets, the kind of long-run average amount that you would win or expect to win is the expected value. The standard error gives a kind of give-or-take number. So that's kind of a typical amount that you might be off from the expected value, sometimes closer, sometimes farther. But just like the average in the SD, it sort of measures center and spread. Okay, it's a slightly different context. So I said this yesterday. Maybe it's worth repeating. The standard error is useful for measuring the likely size of the chance error for things that are essentially random. Okay, so there's no data here, right? I'm just talking about this abstract situation of playing this game 100 times. When you talk about the average in the SD, it's a little bit more concrete. You have an actual data set or list of numbers, and you can add them all up and divide by how many there are to get the average, and you can find the RMS, the deviations from average, to find the SD. So you can actually, you know, crank through and do some arithmetic and figure out exactly what the average in the SD of that particular list of numbers is. So like I said, these are more abstract. It's sort of hypothetically, you know, if we did this, what would we expect and how far off might that be? But there's not really any data or anything, just kind of theoretical. So that's, I think, the easiest way to think about distinguishing, in particular, the SD from the SE, is the SE is talking about likely size of chance error for something random. SD is talking about the kind of typical deviation from average for, you know, for actual data. Okay, so let's do this. So I didn't tell you about the game for this particular bet. For this particular bet, you're either going to win a dollar if the ball lands in a red slot, or you're going to lose a dollar if it doesn't. That's what it means to bet on red, and a dollar is a dollar win. A dollar win when you win is what the casino has decided they want to pay you. Right? And I'll just mention as an aside, if you bet on a single number, obviously, that's going to happen less often, and the casino will pay you more. So the amount that the casino would pay you on a single number, if it comes up, is $35, just to let you know. The way that the book words both of those is, I understand the reason why they do it, but in my mind, it's a little bit stubborn that they're the authors have decided to write it a particular way. I'll tell you what they say. So they say about this that if red comes up, you get your dollar back plus another dollar of winnings, right? Or maybe they say you get your dollar back plus another dollar. So it sort of sounds like you're winning $2, okay? But really you're winning $1, right? You're walking away from the table with $1 more than you came to the table with. And for this bet, they'd say, you know, if you bet on the number 5, you bet $1, so you know, when you come and play, you have to put $1 down. The casino has to see your dollar. And if you lose, they take that dollar. If you win, they give you your dollar back, plus they give you $35. So in some sense, I think it's confusing. This is the reason why I think they're stubborn. People sometimes make the mistake then of considering your winnings to be $36 instead of $35. And in this case, they consider your winnings to be $2 instead of $1. Now, they're sort of being stubborn about wording that way because that's actually physically what happens, right? And I think they want you to realize that just because you're getting your dollar back is sort of irrelevant, right? It's not, that was your dollar. That's the dollar you came with. That's not winnings. So to make it less ambiguous, I tend to say things as you either win $1 or lose $1, okay? Which I think is a little bit more clear. But anyway, just to let you know how to read the book. Okay, so what should we do for the box model here? Any thoughts? So just to remind you of the steps of writing a box model, the first step is to think about what numbers should go in the box. The second step is to think about how many of each. And the third step is to think about how many draws there are going to be. So what numbers are going to go in this box? Yeah? Is that stretch? Yeah. Yeah, negative 1 and 1. Good. So the negative 1, and if you're drawing this, maybe leave a little space in front of each of those. The way that I haven't done this yet because there's always just been one of each number, but I'm going to put how many negative 1s here and how many 1s here in a second. So what you want to think about, and when you think about what numbers go in the box, think about what can happen to the quantity of interest every time you play. Well, what's the quantity you're interested in? It's money in this case. So on each play, your money either goes up by 1 if you win or down by 1 if you lose. So that's why we're using a minus 1 and a 1 here. Okay? So second, any questions about that? Okay, so second question then is how many of each? So we need to make sure that the probabilities come out right, for our box model, that it kind of mimics actual playing. Yeah. Yeah, good. So there are 38 total tickets. 18 tickets are red in the box, and if a red one comes up, we win $1. If any one of the other 20 slots, the ball lands in that slot. If the ball lands in one of the red slots, we win $1. If it lands in any of the other 20 slots, then we lose $1. Okay? And then, that has to sort of mimic what actually happens in the game, that you have an 18 out of 38 chance of winning, and then otherwise 20 out of 38 chance of losing. So I think that's the natural way to make the box. I'll just mention kind of as an aside, as long as the proportion is correct, you don't have to do it 18 and 20. You could, if you felt like it, do 9 and 10, and the chances would be the same. Or you could do 180, 200. Chances would be the same, okay? So it sort of doesn't matter, as long as you get the proportions right, it sort of doesn't matter what the actual number is, right? It's just the chance has to come out right for now. As long as you're doing your draws with replacement, that's true. If you're doing draws without replacement, then it becomes important. But hopefully it's clear that you want the box to look the same on every draw, right? On every play, the box looks the same. So you always want to put your tickets back if you think about the box money. Okay, so then I think it's kind of obvious that this is going to be 100 draws, right? 100 draws, and again, they're with replacement. Okay, so any questions about the box model? So I think, as I mentioned before, a lot of the hard part of the problems right now, I think, in the class, the hard part is kind of be getting the box model done. Once you get the box model done, it's just plugging in values into formulas, right? So in order to find the expected value and the standard error, first of all, we need to find the average of the box and the SD of the box. and then we can use those to get the expected value in standard error. So the average of this box is, it's literally the average of these 38 numbers. So we have 18 ones. One, you can think of that as just 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, 18 times. And then plus 20 tickets marked negative 1, so it's like negative 1, or minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, 20 times. And out of 38, so that comes out to be negative 0.0526. And the SD of the box, I guess I'll, let me give you something a bit of room. So I'm going to use this shortcut. It's kind of the point of doing this example, is that it's a uses that shortcut for a box that isn't a 1-0 box. So the big number is a 1. The small number is a negative 1. And then, so we take 1 minus negative 1 out in front, and then we take square root of 18 out of 38 times 20 out of 38. Okay. And if you do that, you get really close to 1. This is 2 out in front, and this is really close to a half. It's like this is like 0.999, but I'll round it to 1. Okay, so that gives us our average of the box, SD of the box, and now we're ready to find expected value and standard error. If you remember, the expected value is the number of draws times the average of the box. So number of draws is 100, and the average of the box is minus 0.0526. So that means that on average, the units are dollars here. So on average, we would lose a little bit more than $5 in 100 plays. And the standard error is going to be square root of the number of draws, so square root of 100, times the SD of the box is 1. So that's 10. Okay. So the way the book often words things like this is to say that we would lose about $5.26, give or take about $10. Right? So, this is a reasonably large standard error in the sense that you'd sort of like to have some chance of winning money, right? So it's not so unusual that in 100 plays that you'd win a little bit of money. But, you should sort of expect in 100 plays you lose about $5. So that's, I don't know, the way I think about these things is if that's going to be worth it, you better feel like you're willing to spend $5 for the entertainment of playing this game or something like that. And you might end up paying more, you might end up paying less, but that's my statistician's view of negative expected value. Okay? Any thoughts on that? Questions? Okay, so that's that one. So the last section of the chapter, section 5, talks about classifying and counting. I sort of view this as, I don't know, I want to mention classifying and counting. I've mentioned it before, kind of, and also kind of sum up the chapter. So the idea of classifying and counting is that if you want to count the number of times something happens, replace the things you want to count with ones. And everything else with zeros. Okay, so this is basically just like counting the number of heads, which we've done, right? For counting the number of heads, we're basically thinking about the ones representing the heads, the zeros representing the tails, okay? And then drawing from this box, every time we get heads, we're adding 1 to the total number of heads. Every time we get tails, we're adding 0 to the total number of tails. So to kind of extend this idea to this general case where we want to count the number of times something happens, whatever it is that you want to count, like if that thing that you want to count happens, you add 1 to the number of times that it's happened so far. If anything else happens, then you add a 0 to how many times it's happened so far. Okay, so this is a pretty common kind of box that we'll use. And in addition to this kind of box, you'll play around with some boxes. There's one on the homework assignment where you have to think a little bit about, again, what can happen to the quantity of interest every time you draw something. Okay, so every time you whatever's in the box, whatever starts out being in the box, think about if you draw that ticket. Let me say it this way: when thinking about what numbers go in the box, for every ticket, you need to think about, okay, well, what's going to happen to the quantity I'm interested in if I draw that ticket, right? So that's maybe a little bit of a cryptic thing to say, but again, go back to the definition of box models. That basic part, that basic first step of what numbers go in my box, think about the actual physical situation that's going on, and then think, well, for each of those possible things that might happen, what's going to happen to the thing that I actually want to sort of add up the values of. So that quantity of interest is what you want to think about. Okay, so that's that. I'll just mention kind of as an aside to summarize this kind of common kinds of boxes. Let's do this pretty briefly. The first is where you just have numbers in the box. And they don't necessarily mean anything. So things like die rolls are like this. And there are a lot of problems in the book that just have numbered tickets, and the numbers don't necessarily mean anything. So it's fairly abstract. The second kind is that's fairly common is some kind of a gambling problem, like this roulette problem. So you have dollar amounts in box. So dollars in box, I guess. So that's things like this roulette problem where you have an amount you win, amount you lose, something like that. And then the third kind is this classifying and counting. So 0-1 box. So this is classifying and counting. So we have coin tosses, et cetera. There are lots of examples like this. One in the book is for rolling a die, but rather than adding up the results of the die rolls, counting the number of sixes. So again, you're counting the number of something happens, so you think about replacing the things you're counting with ones and replace everything else with a zero. Okay, any questions about those boxes? Sometimes you'll have mixtures of them. Okay, sometimes you'll have like something a little bit more complicated going on, but those are, the three basic kinds that you'll encounter. All right, any questions, anything? Okay, so I want to show you some pictures in a minute, but first of all, so chapter 18 has to do with probability histograms. And normal curve. So I mentioned last time that there's this kind of parallel to what we do in chapter 17 and 18 and what we did in the beginning of the class. So probability histograms are a kind of histograms. I think they'll look fairly familiar. I don't want you to be distracted by that, but this thing doesn't have a blank screen. I'll do this. Okay, so so probability histograms are kind of analogous to what we did in chapter 3 for just histograms, except that rather than drawing a histogram of data, we're going to draw a histogram for this kind of abstract case of like what could happen, okay? What are the chances of different things? And the normal curve, well, probability histograms may or may not look like the normal curve, just like regular histograms may or may not look like the normal curve. So I think I'll have a little bit of time to talk about this toward the end of class, but mostly today we're just going to talk about probability histograms by themselves. So just to give you a quick, simple example, let's think about Karich's data again. And I'll just draw, I'll write down his data really quick. So he did all these coin tosses, and here is his data for 10 through 10,000 heads. He got 4 out of 10, 44 out of 100, 502 out of 1,000, and 5,067 out of 10,000. Okay? So we can think of that as data. So if we think about this data as zeros and ones, right, like 4 heads in 10 coin tosses, if you think about that as a box model, that's like saying that you drew 4 ones and 6 zeros from a box, from a like coin tossing box. So if we want to draw a histogram for that, we can draw a histogram, again, just as data. So I'll draw a few histograms here. For this first line, 4 out of 10, you can think of this as a discrete histogram of just, you know, it's a list of numbers. You have a list of numbers, 4 of them are 1s, 6 of them are zeros. So the histogram is going to look something like this. Again, just a regular histogram like we're used to doing. Okay, so this is like 40, 60% per, I guess the units are like heads here, right? Number of heads. Okay, so this is 0 heads, this is 1 head, the width of this is 1 head, so this kind of works as a histogram. So that's that one. If we do it for, so that's for 10 tosses, just, so these are all going to be histograms. And I'll just squeeze them all in here, I think. So if we do, again, 0, 1, number of heads for 100 tosses. We get 44 ones and 56 zeros, so maybe that looks a little bit like this. They're kind of close to each other. Right, this is 56 and 44. Same units, percent per head. And then if we go to 1,000, 0, 1, number of heads. We've got 502 heads, so it's a very, very slightly taller bar over 502, so you know, just a little smidgen higher for the second one. So if we did the units there, I guess that's 50.2 is the top bar, and 49.8 I won't bother writing in, but there's that other one's 49.8. And then if we go to 10,000, again, we get essentially the same picture, right? 0, 1. Heads. Maybe the difference here is just a little tiny bit more. Okay. All right. So what's happening as we increase the number of tosses? What's happening to the pictures as we increase the number of tosses? Or what should happen? We'll put it that way. Yeah. The bars get closer and closer to each other. And what they're getting close to essentially is 50% each, right? So that's what is, what they're getting closer to is the probability histogram. So that's a statement about the law of averages. So, probability histogram. It is a histogram in the sense that it has total area 100% still, but the percent has a slightly different meaning. In these pictures, we're talking about actual data, a bunch of zeros and ones, and the area of each bar represents the percentage of times that actually happened, right, because it's data. For a probability histogram, it's kind of more abstract. We're talking about this hypothetical situation of flipping a coin, And what the probability histogram represents is what the chance is. So probability histogram represents chance by area. And the total area is 100% or 1, depending on if you want to think about chance in percentage terms or you want to think about chance as fractions. Okay, so probability histogram for this situation, again, it's just a 0 and a 1. This is thinking about for one coin toss. So one coin toss, this is a probability histogram. So no coins need to be tossed at all, right? For each of these pictures, somebody had to toss the coin to get data to draw the pictures for a regular histogram. But you don't have to draw, you don't have to toss any coins to get a probability histogram. You just have to figure out what the chances are. Okay? So this is 50% per head. I'll still call it 50% per head. Kind of strange units. It's also just 50% since the width of each one is 1, but to kind of be consistent in our notation about what the height represents. Or you could think about it as just a half. So sometimes for discrete probability histograms especially, you might just put a half there, and then the height of each bar is the chance. The width of each bar is 1. Okay, so for a probability histogram in general, it's pretty common and pretty reasonable to just have the y-axis be the chance. Okay. Okay. So any questions about that? Okay. So in a sense, each of those pictures is trying to look like this, but there's some chance error involved. So because of the chance error, each of those pictures will be a little bit different. We're talking about chance error in percentage terms. Okay, because what's going on in the picture is the percentage of heads is what's relevant. So as that percentage of heads gets closer to 50%, we get closer and closer to the probability histogram. And the law of averages says as we increase the number of draws, the chance error in percentage terms should get smaller. So we should get closer to this. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, so that's one case. That's sort of the simplest probability histogram there is. So let's look at something a little bit. Oh, shoot. I just turned off. All right, sorry. I just turned it off. So I need to wait for it to turn off and then turn it on again. So what I'm going to show you, let's say, is basically, first of all, a few regular histograms for sums of two die rolls. So just like those pictures up there, those are regular histograms. Imagine it as though it's data. What I'm going to show you is basically this. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Sorry. People over there can't see, but so two draws. So two draws from that box. So what happens? We're going to get something between 2 and 12, right? We're going to get something between 2 and 12, okay? So whereas here for one coin toss, the number of heads is either 0 or 1. Here we're going to get something between 2 and 12. So you'll see that x-axis will look like that, and the picture will be actual data for this situation. Okay. Now it's at least warming up. It's in the right direction. Okay. So the first one is going to be for 36 repetitions of this process, so essentially 36 data points. Just like here, we had 10 data points, 100 data points, 1,000 data points, 10,000 data points. Each data point itself is one coin toss, right? So 10, 100, et cetera, zeros and ones. Right? So here in this case, the top one is 36 sums of two die rolls. Okay? So for each sum of two die rolls, you get something between 2 and 12. Let me see if I can focus that a little bit better. I guess that didn't really do much, but so each one of these bars represents the actual proportion of times that that thing happened, right? So just like, you know, for these bars, maybe these bars here, the bar over the one represents the percentage of times that we actually got heads. So 50.67% is the area of that first, the bar over the one, and 49.33 is the area of the bar over the zero. So in 36 repetitions of rolling two dice, for example, the 10 never happened, right? The 2 and the 12 happened once. Looks like the 3 happened twice. And you can sort of roughly figure out how many times each thing happened. So it's like real data, right? Okay. So this one is for doing the same thing 360 times. So I've shaded this bar over the 9 to just sort of keep track of that and see what happens to it. Okay. It represents, again, the proportion or the percentage of times that thing happened. Any questions about those pictures? All right, so let's look at what happens if we go to 3600. So there's some kind of a, you know, the first one is, looks pretty random, right? It doesn't really look like you can tell what's going on. But if we get to these two pictures, you can kind of see that a pattern is starting to emerge, right? So what do you think that it's starting to look like? Okay, so it's not looking like the normal curve, right? And I want to just highlight that, because I think that's a really common belief, is that everything should look like the normal curve, right? There's no reason why this should look like the normal curve, right? Does this look like the normal curve? Not so much. There's a probability histogram, but it doesn't have to look like the normal curve. It looks whatever it looks like. Okay. Sometimes probability histograms do look like the normal curve, but in general, I'll tell you when they do in a little bit, but in general, they don't really need to. For one coin toss, these are the real chances. You know, 50% chance of a 0, 50% chance of a 1. There's no reason for it to look like the normal curve. Okay, it's tall in the middle, it's shorter on the sides, but it doesn't really look like the normal curve. This is what the probability histogram looks like. Again, I've drawn the box model on here, right? So we have two draws from this box, meaning that we are, you know, rolling a die twice and adding up the outcomes. And these should look similar, right? But not exact. There's still, you can sort of see a little bit of wobbliness in the top one. If you look along here, there's a straight line. Right? This is sort of a tent. It doesn't really look like the normal curve, okay? The normal curve should be this bell-shaped thing. And again, this is tall in the middle and short on the sides, but it's not really a kind of bell-shaped thing. What are the chances? Well, what's the chance of getting a sum of two dice equal to 2? 1 out of 36. You need to get 2 ones. So the area of this bar is going to be 1 out of 36. What's this one going to be? This one's going to be 2 out of 36. It's the chance of getting the sum of two dice equal to 3. So you could either get a 1-2 or a 2-1, basically. There are two ways for it to happen. If you think about the grid, like 1 through 6, 1 through 6, right? One thing up in the corner, which is the chance of getting 1-1, and then two ways to get a 3, three ways to get a 4, four ways to get a 5, five ways to get a 6, six ways to get a 7, and then it goes back down again. Maybe I'll draw that real quick, that grid. You can sort of count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So I'm going to draw in this picture what the sum of the two dice is. So in that corner, it's a 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 4, 5, 5, 5, 5. So, okay, I don't know if you can see that so well. But, in the upper left corner, there's a 2, meaning the sum of the two dice is a 2, and then 3, 3, meaning 2, 1, or a 1, 2, and then 3, 1, 2, 2, 1, 3, Those are the ways we get into 4, and so forth. And then at the end, we, you know, 6, 6 would give us a sum of 12. Okay? So there's one way to do this, two ways to do that, three ways to do that. Draw it out for yourself if you want. So that's what all the chances are. So there's kind of a law of averages thing going on in every single bar simultaneously. So in this picture, you have two bars. Each one of them is getting closer and closer to 50%, right, as we go through these empirical histograms. So a regular histogram is sometimes called an empirical histogram, just meaning that it's based on data. So as we go through those empirical histograms, increase the number of draws, each one of those bars is getting closer and closer to 50% area, which is what the law of averages says should happen. The same thing is happening here for every single bar, that the area of each bar should be getting closer and closer to the actual chance of that thing. Right? So these shaded bars over the 9 that I've drawn should be getting closer and closer in area to the bar in the probability histogram. And you can see that, you know, it sort of looks like that's happening, right? There's a little bit of, like, that 3 looks like maybe it's a little bit taller than it ought to be. I don't know. There's sort of a big jump between 2 and 3, but then a smaller jump between 3 and 4. So it's not quite as regular as this, where it's, like, hopefully visually clear that the bar over the 3 is twice as big as the bar over 1, and then you have the same step here, same step here. All these steps have the same size, whereas there the steps are different sizes. Okay? Questions about that? Okay, so again, what I'm trying to show through these sequence of empirical histograms, the first 3 empirical histograms, is that they get closer and closer to this probability histogram. That's a law of averages thing, basically, that says that that should happen. But whether or not this looks like the normal curve is, I haven't tackled yet, right? What that should look like. Okay, any questions on any of that? Okay, so maybe I'll at least get as far as showing you some more pictures. So let's look at coin tosses. All right, so this is... So I wrote some things on here. If you want to think this in a binomial, I crossed it out, but if you want to think about it in a binomial context, it's n equals 10, p equals 0.5, meaning n trials, p is 0.5. But I think it's easier to think about it just as 10 coin tosses. So we have this box, 0, 1, 10 tosses. This situation here, we've drawn a probability histogram for 1 coin toss. Okay? I know up there in the empirical histograms we toss a lot of coins to get the data, but it's really a picture of 1 coin toss, right? For 1 coin toss, you either get a 0 or a 1. In 10 coin tosses, if you add up all 10 numbers, you could get anything from 0 to 10. Okay? So this is thinking about 10 coin tosses, I don't know, sort of all at once, adding up the results. So we're thinking about that box model as opposed to one draw like that. Okay, so this looks kind of like the normal curve, right? More so than that tenth thing for the 2 die rolls, I hope. And again, each bar represents the chance of some particular outcome. So this bar I've shaded in the middle represents the chance that in 10 coin tosses, you should get a 5. So I did that one back in the binomial lecture. The area of that bar is about 24.6%, I think. 24.62, I think. So we can find the area of that bar in the usual way by the binomial theorem if we want, binomial formula if we want. It's almost exactly the same, it's pretty close to the same area under the curve between these points, right? So you might start thinking about how you would do normal approximation here, right? To think about, like, approximating the area of that rectangular bar using some area under the curve. And it should be fairly close in some cases, but not so much in others. So here's, you think about this one, the curve kind of follows, but, you know, the bars stick out here and there. It's a little bit hard to tell maybe just how accurate it is. Here's 100 coin tosses. So the area I've shaded is between 45 and 55. We'll talk more about this next time, but that's what that is. So, again, it's 100 draws from that box. And then as we move on from 100 to 1,000, now it's, I think, getting pretty dramatic just how closely the probability histogram follows the normal curve, right? There are bars here, and remember, the bars represent the truth, okay? The bars, the area of each bar represents the actual chance of some number of heads. So it's centered at 500. There's some bar in the center there, and the area of that bar represents the real chance of getting 500 heads and 1,000 coin tosses. But you can see that, you know, as you increase the number of tosses, you get pretty close to the normal curve. So what's going on here is that as this number increases, you get closer and closer to the normal curve, the number of draws there. The number of draws here is 1. So, you know, that should not look like the normal curve. There's no reason it should. For my other series of pictures with the die rolls, that number was a 2, right? So for 1, 2 draws from a box, look at the probability histogram, probably not going to follow the normal curve. But if that number increases, the probability histogram does look a lot like the normal curve. All right? So we'll talk a little bit more about, like, a rule for establishing, like, when it's close enough, that kind of stuff next time. Okay? Any questions, thoughts? Okay, so we'll finish up chapter 18 next time.